Thank you all. Thank you all very much. Thanks for coming. Please be seated. Thanks for being here. Yeah, I can see. Did you say you love Laura? So do I. You stole my line. Thanks for coming. This is an amazing experience here. I see why my buddy Gatlin finds that extra note when he stands out here and sings. It's a fantastic call. The last time Laura and I were here, we were honoring Mother and Dad for their 50th wedding anniversary. Mother thought he'd lost his mind when he said, "Honey, I want to celebrate 50 years of marriage at the Grand Ole Opry." I said, "God, you got to hear judgment, Dad." So thanks for coming. I'm really thrilled to be here. I should have probably come before I gave my speech. Like when I was on the plane flying down here, I thought, how cool would it be to give a State of the Union address in a Porter Wagoner outfit? I do want to give you some of the thoughts behind what I said in my State of the Union. That's what I'm coming to do. You know, it's one thing to give the speech. I think it's important to come here to Nashville to tell people the reason why I said some of the things I said. I think it'll help you understand why I have made some of the decisions I have made. You know, one of the interesting things about the presidency is we get to entertain a lot of my favorite folks to entertain are the people that Laura and I grew up with. You know, I like my buddies from West Texas. I liked them when I was young. I liked them when I was middle aged. I liked them before I was president. I liked them during president. I liked them after president. And it's fun to have them come to the White House. It's neat to show off this fantastic experience that Laura and I are being able to go through. They first walk in there and they're amazed at the White House. And the second thing is they're amazed I'm in the White House. I always say, what's it like to be president of the United States? And after I say it's just a huge honor, which it is, I say if I could give you the job description, it would be decision maker. I have to make a lot of decisions. And today what I'd like to do is share with you why I made decisions in the context of the State of the Union I gave last night. Before I do, I really am thrilled Laura's traveling with me. She's a great first lady. She is... proud to be traveling with your two United States Senators, the majority leader of the United States Senate, Bill Frist. He's a good man, a good guy to deal with. He is doing a fantastic job of herding cats. And I'm proud to be here with Senator Lamar Alexander as well. A little later on, I'm going to talk about a key component of the competitive agenda, and that is to make sure folks are educated for the jobs of the 21st century. And I will tell you that Lamar had a lot to do with planning this in my mind. As you know, made his fame here in Tennessee for being a great education governor. You'll be pleased to hear he's carried over that passion into the halls of the United States Senate. So in case I forget to give him credit later on, he deserves a lot of credit for making sure that we're competitive in the 21st century. I appreciate the members of the State House who are here. Thanks for serving. Appreciate those in the local government who are here. I understand the mayor's here. Mr. Purcell, I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day. I know you didn't ask for any advice. My only advice is fill the potholes. Works every time, Mayor. I want to thank the good folks here at the Gaylord Entertainment for letting me come by and just explain some things to the people of Tennessee. This is such a fantastic facility. I had been here before on my wedding day, 50th wedding anniversary, when I was happened to be involved in the baseball business. I can remember the winter meetings we held here. And we're still looking for two of our guys that work for us. They got lost in one of the 14 lobbies in this fantastic facility. It's a wonderful place. I want to thank those of you who wear a nation's uniform who have joined us today. Strong. I say that because America is working hard to protect ourselves. We're spreading freedom. Our economy is vigorous and strong as well. But there's some uncertainty in people's minds. People are uncertain in spite of our strong union because of war. And I understand that. I mean, it is my job is as much educator-in-chief as it is commander-in-chief. And during times of uncertainty, it's important for me to do what I'm doing today, which is explain the path to victory, to do the best I can to articulate my optimism about the future. But I understand there's an anxiety about the time of war. That's natural, seems like to me. Even though this economy is growing, and it's strong, when you think that we recognize we've overcome a lot. This year alone, overcome higher energy prices and natural disasters, and yet we really are the envy of the world. Our economy is the envy of the world. And yet people are changing jobs a lot. And there's competition from India and China, which creates some uncertainty. My worry is that people see that uncertainty and decide to adopt isolationist policies or protectionist policies. In other words, in uncertain times, it's easy for people to lose confidence in the capacity of this country to lead and to shape our future. Last night in my speech, I talked about a couple of things, and one of the things was that we must never lose sight of our capacity to lead this world toward peace. And that we must never fear. And we must never fear competition. But on the other hand, we've got to put solid policy in place to make sure that we can compete. First, let me talk about foreign policy and why I'm concerned about isolationism. We're at war. A lot of my thinking in the speech I gave last night and speeches that I have been given is based upon my understanding that we're at war. On September 11, 2001, I vowed to the American people that we would not rest and tire in order to protect us. And I have never forgotten that vow. As a matter of fact, every day, every day of my presidency, I think about this war. That's what you've got to understand. And so when you hear me give a speech and talk about the dangers to America, they are real, not imagined. You know, some would like us to look at the world the way we would hope it would be. My job as your president is to look at the world the way it is. And I clearly see the threats to America. My job is to worry about those threats. That's not your job. We got a lot of people in government worrying about those threats on your behalf. So you can go about your life. That's what we want. I knew after September the 11th, people would, tend to forget the nature of the enemy and forget the war. Because it's natural. Who wants to live all your day worried about the next attack? That's my job, to worry about the attack. It's the job of the intelligence community and our military and law enforcement. That's what you pay us to do. But I also recognize that if we ever get weary or tired or uncertain and withdraw within our boundaries, the enemy's not going away. The enemy is the bunch of cold-blooded killers that have taken a great religion, taken parts of a great religion and converted it into an ideology that they perverted a great religion. And they have an ideology. We've been through ideological struggles in the past. We've had an ideological struggle against fascism and communism. And we're in that same kind of struggle now. That's what's important for the American people to understand. They have ambition. They want to spread their totalitarian empire. People say, what do you mean by that? Well, I say, the best thing to think about is what life was like in Afghanistan for the Taliban, under the Taliban, for the people under the Taliban. It's a life where young girls couldn't get an education. You talk about a dark vision of the future. It's a life where if you didn't agree with their view of religion, you were punished. It's a life in which freedom of expression was not encouraged. It was a dim view of the world. That's what these people think like. They have stated clearly their desire to hurt us. And we've got to take what they say seriously. When the enemy says something, an enemy which attacked us brutally on September the 11th, I would hope you would want the people in government to take their words seriously, which I did. They have said they want to drive us out of Iraq. They have said they want weapons of mass destruction. They've got an ideology that they want to spread. And they want us to retreat. That's what they have openly stated. And that's why it's essential that we remain active in the world and keep the lead for peace. We have the duty to protect the American people. And so our strategy is to never give in. It's to never lose heart. This enemy has got one weapon. And it's the weapon of fear. What a fantastic country we live in. We deeply care about every human life. The life of a child in Baghdad is precious. And so when we see these killers kill somebody, a young child outside a hospital, or one of our soldiers handing out candy, we weep. Because Americans have a deep compassion for every human being. And the only weapon they have is to cause us to weep and lose our nerve. And as I said last night, it's something I truly believe. They don't understand the nature of America. We love our freedom, and we will do everything in our power to defend our freedom. So we're on the hunt for Al-Qaeda, and we're going to stay on the hunt. And we will bring them to justice. No doubt in my mind, we are bringing them to justice. We're making great progress in dismantling Al-Qaeda. And the others who hide, we won't be able to hide long enough. We're using every asset in our power to keep them on the defense. define them and bring them to justice. Secondly, I said something that I meant early on in this war against these terrorists, and that is that two countries, if you harbor a terrorist, you're equally as guilty as a terrorist. In other words, one of the... Because I understand that these terrorist networks need safe haven in order to plan and plot. We're not dealing with nation states, we're dealing with an ideological movement that needs a nation in which to hide. And so we made it clear that if you're complicit with the murders, you're just as guilty as the murders themselves. And that's why we took the action in Afghanistan. We gave the Taliban an opportunity to get rid of Al-Qaeda. They chose not to, and we acted. Thirdly, when we see a threat, we've got to deal with the threat. I remember growing up in Midland. Gambling grew up in Odessa, by the way, right now, where our league atlas did. It's, I was white collar and blue collar. Anyway, I'm president, he's a singer. Anyway, you can tell, I can, when I put the needle out, it's a sign of affection. Just don't give him the mic. Anyway, when we grew up, oceans protected us. Seemed like, you know, felt pretty safe and secure from an attack on American soil. We were concerned about a nuclear threat, but nevertheless, we felt secure because we were isolated from threats, it seemed like. September 11th changed my way of thinking. Changed my way of thinking on a lot of things. One way it changed is that when we see a threat, we've got to deal with it. We can't hope for the best. One of the lessons of September 11th is threats should not be allowed to fully materialize, otherwise it will cause harm to the American people. I saw a threat in Iraq. The world saw a threat in Iraq. We gave Saddam Hussein a chance to deal with the world in good faith by honoring the United Nations Security Council resolutions. He chose. It was his choice. He chose to defy the resolutions, and so we took action. The world is safer, and America is more secure without Saddam Hussein in power. I recognize in a free society like ours, there can be and should be debate on big matters. I welcome the debate. But as I said last night to Congress, whether you agree or not agree with the decision, this country has one option, and that's victory in Iraq. I'm looking forward to... I say that because the enemy has said they want to drive us out of Iraq and use it as a safe haven. We've got to take the word seriously of those who want to do us harm. I want to describe right quick our plans for victory in Iraq. The first of all, anytime we put our troops in harm's way, we got to go in with victory in mind. And the victory is for Iraq to be a democracy that can sustain itself and govern itself and defend itself. A country which will be an ally in the war on terror. A country which will deny safe haven to the Al-Qaeda. And a country which will serve as a powerful example of liberty and freedom in a part of the world that is desperate for liberty and freedom. The Iraqis have shown incredible courage and a strong desire to live in democracy. If you really think about last year, the year 2005, the progress toward democracy was remarkable. Any way you look at it, it was remarkable. I mean, this young democracy has gone from tyranny. But there was a brutal dictator that killed or had killed thousands of people to a country which had a transitional government and election, to a country which wrote a progressive constitution for the Middle East and had that constitution ratified, to a country in which 11 million people voted in the elections last December. You see, one of the things that... One the inherent parts of my foreign policy is my strong belief that liberty is universal, that everybody desires to be free, that freedom is not just a Western idea or an American idea. Freedom is lodged in the soul of every person. Let me put it another way to you. I believe there's an Almighty, and I believe the Almighty's gift is freedom to every single person in this world. And if you believe that, I'm just getting wound up here. I told Laura I'd try to keep it under a couple of hours. If you believe that freedom is universal, then it shouldn't surprise you that 11 million people, more or less, went to the polls. People want to be free. And the Iraqis are showing the world that. Secondly, we've got to make sure their economy is able to function as good as possible so that people see the benefits of democracy. It's one thing to have elections. It's another thing for people to say, democracy is good for me. Democracy is good for my family. So we're working on reconstruction and fighting corruption and making sure that there are tangible benefits. And it's been difficult because the enemy is not only brutal in terms of killing people, the enemy is just relentless in trying to destroy infrastructure so that people cannot see the benefits of democracy. And the third aspect, as one that I know is dear to hearts of many people, is, how long will we be in Iraq? And the answer is this, the security aspect. And that is that if people want to be free, and if 11 million people choose to vote, the question people raise is there a willingness for the Iraqis to defend their own freedom? And I will tell you the answer we have seen, our commanders on the ground have seen, is absolutely. Absolutely. There's a great bravery amongst these Iraqi soldiers. Our job is to convert their desire to protect their new democracy into effective forces, and that's what we're doing. We've changed our training patterns. When I first got in there, one of the things I talked about over the Christmas season, the holiday season, prior to the holiday season, was that we've adjusted. That's what happened. We see things and we change. We've done things differently. When we first went in there, we helped train an army for an external threat. Well, sure enough, the external threat wasn't nearly as significant as the internal threat. And so we start adjusting our training tactics. And we got good advice from members of the Senate and House from both political parties who went to Iraq and came back and said, here's what we've seen. And so we're changing. And the security forces of Iraq are up to about 230,000 more or less. But the question is not just numbers. I first asked about numbers. You read about these suiciders knocking people off that were trying to stand in these recruiting stations. And so the question is, are you able to get recruits? If it's dangerous to sign up, are you able to sign people up? And the answer is absolutely. People wanted to serve the Iraqi military, which is a good sign about whether or not we're succeeding in our mission in training folks to defend their freedom. If they're willing to sign up in the face of suiciders, it says something about their desire to protect their country. The second question is, can they do the job? Are we training them well enough so they can take the fight on their own? And the elections was an interesting example where the Iraqis were in the lead, and the violence in the last election was significantly lower than the violence in the first election. Today by video, I met not only in a room with my national security team, but we had the ambassador and General Casey from Baghdad. And it's interesting to be able to communicate with your commanders on the ground in real time. And the reason I bring that up is that they are constantly updating the national security team to me about the effectiveness of these troops and how much territory we're turning over to the Iraqi troops. What I have told the American people is, as the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down. As the Iraqis are capable of taking the fight to the enemy, we will reduce our troop levels. We have two less brigades there than we thought. In other words, the troops that are being trained, the troops that we're training are more effective, more capable of taking the fight to the enemy. The commanders on the ground say, we need less American presence. Now, I'm going to talk to you some about timetables and withdrawals and all that business. It is a mistake to have a definitive timetable of withdrawal because the enemy will react, the Iraqis will react, and it's not fair to our men and women to wear the uniform. So I will make my decisions based upon what these commanders tell me. That's what you expect of the commander-in-chief. My job is to set the strategy. I just told you what victory is all about. We've defined victory. And now it's up to the commanders on the ground to help us achieve that victory. And if they say these Iraqis are capable of taking the fight, they're there firsthand to tell me that. And then we'll reduce our troops based upon their recommendation, not based upon the politics in Washington, D.C. We can't be isolationists and win the war on terror. And we can't be isolationists either because it would prevent us from doing our duty around the world. To not only make this world a place where terrorists have trouble recruiting, but to live to that admonition, to whom much is given, much is required. Effective foreign policy recognizes that we can help change conditions on the ground to make life better for future generations of Americans. And I believe that helping defeat HIV/AIDS on the continent of Africa is not only reflects the great compassion of America, but it will improve lives for generations of Americans to come. I believe defeating hopelessness and despair and helping others defeat poverty is in our national interest. I also know it reflects the deep character of the American people. If this country were to become isolationist and withdraw and say we don't care about conditions of life elsewhere, we're not only ceding the ground to terrorists, we're not doing our duty as a compassionate nation. Do you realize we feed a lot of the hungry in the world, and I'm proud of that record, that we're providing incredibly important, life-saving, antiretroviral drugs to help defeat HIV/AIDS on the continent of Africa. There's a pandemic sweeping that continent, and the United States of America is leading the world in helping save lives. Do you realize that when the tsunami hit earlier this past year, it was the United States military that moved in and provided immediate help and aid and comfort and organization. Our choppers were flying rescue missions in Pakistan after the devastating earthquake. In my judgment, an active foreign policy, a one that aids the suffering and helps the poor, is one that is in the interest of the United States of America, both short-term and long-term. Finally, if we were to withdraw, not only would we cede ground to the terrorists and endanger this country, we would miss a fantastic opportunity to help spread liberty. And in my speech, I mentioned Roosevelt and Kennedy, Truman, and Reagan. I did so because I wanted to remind the American people that these leaders were one that acted in confidence in the bill and in our values. They understood when America led, not only was America better off, but the world was. And we're spreading freedom now. I'm mindful of the fact that I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States. So I had lawyers, Attorney General, and Justice Department look at what I was doing. I'm also mindful that people want to make sure the President is safe for our civil liberties while we protect the country, that there needs to be a balance. And so this is the program that I became comfortable with Ed Malice. And confident that I had the legal authority to do what I did. And so let me tell you what I did without talking about the operating details. I'm sure you understand why you don't want the president or anybody talking about the operating details. If you're at war, and you're trying to stop the enemy from attacking you, why in the world would you want to tell the enemy what you're doing to stop them? So I've authorized NSA to listen to a phone call from outside the United States in or inside the United States out. In other words, this is not a program where we're listening to phone calls inside the United States. One of the people making the call has to be Al-Qaeda, suspected Al-Qaeda, and or affiliate. This is the program which we have briefed key members of the Congress a lot of times. It is constantly reviewed by a legal team, constantly reviewed. It is constantly reviewed inside and saved by a legal team. We are safeguarding your liberties. Federal courts have ruled that a president has constitutional authority to use foreign intelligence surveillance against enemies. Previous presidents have used the same constitutional authority I have. I've got statutory authority as well. Congress passed the authorization to use military force against Al-Qaeda after September the 11th, and the Supreme Court, in a recent opinion, ruled that Congress gave me the authority to use what's called the Fundamental Incidents of War. And it was Congress authorized me to use force and the Fundamental Incidents of War, which means, in this case, you can't defeat the enemy until you know when the enemy's going to hit. And therefore, using this surveillance to find out the intention of the enemy is a fundamental incident of war to protect the American people. Let me put it to you in Texan. If Al-Qaeda is calling in the United States, we want to know. Here's the challenge at home. We've got a great economy. The American people are amazing when you unleash their creativity and talent. The entrepreneurial spirit of this country is strong when we reinforce that entrepreneurial spirit. Over the past 2.5 years, this economy's created 4.6 million new jobs. The unemployment rate is 4.9%. Small businesses are flourishing. After-tax incomes for sole ones is up 7%. Productivity is very high, which is important for quality of life and higher standards of living. Home ownership is at an all-time high. More minorities own a home today in America than ever before in our nation's history. And this economy is doing just fine. But the question is, how do we stay competitive? What do we do to make sure in a world in which competition is becoming fiercer and fiercer, what do we do to stay ahead of it? Now, some would say, protect yourself by withdrawing from the world. I think that is a huge mistake. Protectionism doesn't work. Protectionism would default to other countries in the world. That's not the American way. America must be confident and lead and do what is necessary to keep us competitive. I've got some ideas for you. First, in order to make sure we're competitive, this economy has got to continue to grow. Last night I said an interesting statistic, which I don't know, because otherwise I wouldn't have said it. But, I said the tax relief we passed left $880 billion in the hands of American families and small businesses and entrepreneurs. See, my philosophy is that the more money you got, the more of your own money you keep, you will save and invest and spend, and that's how this economy grows. and the tax relief we passed is working because the American people are responding. And so how do we make sure that we have economic vitality and growth? Well, one thing you don't want to do is to take money out. If it's work, why take money out of your pocket? And the tax relief we passed is set to expire. If Congress doesn't do anything, your taxes are going to go up, which in my judgment will be bad for the economy. In order to keep America competitive, the Congress needs to make the tax relief permanent. You'll hear folks say, well, we've got to run up your taxes in order to balance the budget. That's not the way it works in Washington. They're going to raise your taxes so they can find new ways to spend your money. That's how it works. So I want the tax cuts permanent, and I want to work on the deficit by controlling federal spending. We can meet priorities. See, you got to set priorities in order to meet priorities. So long as we've got kids in harm's way, a priority will be to make sure our troops have what's necessary to do their job. We got a plan to cut this deficit in half by 2009. It's just going to take Congress making some hard choices. Part of my job is to present a budget that gives them a chance to show how to cut that deficit in half by 2009. Looking forward to working with them on seeing this effect. The long-term problem we got is mandatory spending. I want to spend a little time on it. There's got a real issue with Social Security and Medicare. And the reason why is guys like me are fixing to retire. I turned 62 retirement age in 2008, which is a convenient coincidence. I'm looking around, I see some other baby boomers out there too. And we're going to stress the system. There's a lot of us getting ready to retire. Heck of a lot more than have been retired. And we've been promised a lot. And a lot of young guys are going to be having to pay to a system that's flat and broke. That's the reality. It's hard for me to be the president to look at young workers and young people coming to work for paying payroll taxes in a system that I know is going broke. It is. We've been promised too much and too few people paying into the system. And now we need to do something about it. Because this mandatory spending, this entitlement programs, are going to make it really hard for future Congresses and future taxpayers. I tried last year with the Social Security plan. I thought my job was not only to raise the issue, but to come up with some solutions. One of my first objectives was to explain to the American people we got a problem. I believe that until Congress hears from the people that we got a problem, that their attitude is going to be, nobody thinks we got a problem, I do anything about it. People now know we got a problem. Last night I said to the members of Congress the truth. We're not going to be able to solve this issue until we bring Republicans and Democrats together. This is a big issue to solve in the way we do. We can get the job done. We don't have to cut benefits. We just got to slow them down so the next generation can afford them. You realize my benefits, your benefits grow faster than the rate of inflation. I mean, there's ways to make it work, but it's going to require a new attitude in Washington, D.C. There's too much politics up there. There's too much zero sum. I want the Democrats in Capitol here to hear loud and clear. I want a bipartisan solution on mandatory and entitled spending for the sake of future generations of Americans. Four other issues right quick. I feel it. They didn't come all the way to hear this week. I'm kind of getting short. I'll make it quick. important for us to stay competitive to open up markets, the temptations to shut markets down. I'm confident in our ability. I'm confident in our farmers. I'm confident in our entrepreneurs. I know that the job of the president is to work to open up markets and level the playing field. My attitude is this: we say to countries, you treat us the way we treat you. And when they do, nobody can outcompete the American worker and farmer and entrepreneur. A big issue is immigration. It's important for us to get this issue solved so that we can be competitive as we go out into the 21st century. First of all, the obligation of the federal government to enforce their borders is to make sure that and I want to thank Leader Frist for passing a strong appropriations bill to provide resources necessary for more border patrol technology along the border. Listen, the border is wrong. And it's not easy to enforce, but with proper use of technology, some physical barriers, I think we'll be able to do a much better job. The second issue along the border, by the way, is that when we get somebody sneaking into our country illegally, we just can't release them back into the system. We've got to have more detention space. We've got to have more detention space so that people, you know, it used to be the case, and a lot of the folks would say, all right, check back in with your immigration judge here in 45 days, and you guys say, yeah, you bet. See you later. So we're changing that along the border. I do want to talk about the border issue. A lot of people here in America have come to do jobs, and Americans won't do a job. And they're here because they can make money for their families. You should tell people in Texas that family values didn't stop at the Rio Grande River. If you're a mother or dad and you want to put food on the table for your children and you had a choice between, you know, $5 and $50, you'd have the $50 if you could. I believe a very significant part of enforcing our border, making it easier for the Border Patrol to do the job, is to in this system that encourages smuggling and pressure on the border by people sneaking across and saying, if there's somebody that's willing to do a job in America, let's give them a foolproof pass so they can be here on a temporary basis. Now, I'm against amnesty, and the reason I am is I believe if you grant amnesty to people that are here, it'll cause another wave of people who want to come. But I am for recognizing reality and saying that if you're doing a job, if you're an employer, you're looking for somebody doing a job an American won't do, then here's a card for a temporary worker. That's a humane way to treat the issue. You know, I can't stand a system that's caused people to get stuck in the back of 18-wheelers and they're driving across the desert. You know, we have, because of our policy, we have caused there to be a whole smuggling industry and a forgery industry. If you're out there working and somebody shows up and you can't find somebody to find work and it shows, show me your card, you don't know whether it's real or not real. There's people forging cards in order to, you know, help these people find work. We got Border Patrol agents chasing people, getting smuggled across the border to do work. If you're able to have a rational plan on a temporary worker basis, it doesn't seem like to me that I don't have to try to sneak across the border, or Border Patrol would be able to do a better job on drugs and terrorists and guns that are trying to be smuggled in and out of this country. Immigration is an important issue, and I'm looking forward to working with Congress to get a job done on behalf of the American people. I want to talk about health care right quick. The job of the federal government is to take care of the elderly and the poor. We're rolling out a Medicare plan that's going to make medicine for our seniors modern, up-to-date, and work well. It's a really important reform. Listen, if you say we're going to provide medicine for our seniors, you need to provide the best medicine possible for our seniors. And that means including prescription drug coverage for the seniors. And that's what's happening. We got millions of people are signing up for this program. We've been in it for about 4 weeks. We're going to correct problems. Most of the people signing up will find out it's a good deal. I urge seniors to look at this program carefully and sign up. We also have an obligation to the poor, which we're taking care of, and Medicaid. But I want to give you another way of dealing with medicine other than having the federal government run it all, which I'm all really opposed to. I think long ago I had policies that encouraged indoctrination relationships, strengthen their relationship. Secondly, we've got to be wise about how we help control costs. One way to control costs is to spread information technology out throughout the healthcare field. And let me put it to you this way. Healthcare is kind of lagging behind when it comes to using modern technology. Think about it. You got docs still writing out those files and handing a file to you and say, you know, take it down the hall. You know, you're moving papers still in a paperless world. The problem is, not only are you moving paper, but doctors can't write in the first place. It creates inefficiencies in the system. There are too many medical errors. By spreading information technology, which Bill Frist and I went to a hospital, I think it's here in Nashville, where they've got a modern information technology system being put in place, they're going to save 20-30% on healthcare costs. It's a rational way of helping control healthcare without the federal government getting in your business. I'm for allowing small businesses to pool risk across jurisdictional boundaries so they have the opportunity of buying healthcare at the same discount big businesses get. I am a big believer in health savings accounts. For those of you who don't know health savings accounts, investigate health savings accounts. They're an innovative way to make sure the doctor-patient relationship is strong, that people are in charge of making the healthcare decisions themselves, that there is an incentive to taking care of your body through good exercise and good nutrition. It's a way to save money tax-free. Got to get the United States Senate to pass medical liability reform. You don't have to worry about Frist. No, he understands. We got a problem with OBGYNs. I said last time statistics should alarm the American people. There are 1,500 counties in America in which a woman can't find an OBGYN. A lot of that has to do with lawsuits, driving good docs out of practice. This isn't right, folks. This isn't right. It's time for those senators who are blocking that bill. Those senators who are representing the trial lawyers of America to understand the damage they're doing to the healthcare industry of this country. Getting warmed up. In order to stay competitive, America must end its dependence on oil. When you're hooked on oil from the Middle East, it means you've got an economic security issue and a national security issue. And I spoke last night to some exciting opportunities here in America. I know that technology is going to enable us to diversify away from being dependent on hydrocarbon, from oil. Let me talk about cars, and that's really the area where we can achieve a lot of independence. We use a lot of foreign oil in our automobiles, and we drive a lot. People say the cafe is a cafe that actually we have increased cafe standards for certain types of vehicles during manufacturation, and that's important. And as is, you know, giving people choice, you know, the marketplace function is important. But most important of all, it seems like to me, if we recognize the fact that being dependent upon oil is a problem for the long term, then why don't we figure out how to drive our cars using a different type of fuel? Now, let me talk about two things that we're working on. I said last night we spent $10 billion since I've been president on research, and we're close to some really interesting breakthroughs. One such breakthrough is advanced batteries, which will make the hybrid car or the electric car much more affordable and much more suitable to the consumer demands. You want your battery running out halfway between here and somewhere else. But I do want to talk about ethanol. We don't make ethanol out of corn right now. We're very close to a breakthrough where we'll be able to figure out how to make ethanol from other forms, other materials, like grasses or woods. Now think about that. All of a sudden, you know, maybe we may be in the energy business, you know, by being able to grow grass on a ranch and have it harvested and converted into energy. And that's what we're close to happening. We're told that if we continue to focus on research, we'll be able to, within 6 years, have a competitive fuel to gasoline. Now people say, well, that's great. How about the automobile? Will they be able to use it? 4.5 million cars today are flex fuel automobiles. In other words, they need to use gasoline or ethanol. So the technology is there for the automobile. And we're close to the technology of providing a competitive fuel to gasoline by converting that which we grow into fuel. It's coming. It's an exciting time. I can't wait to work with Congress to continue promoting this kind of research so that someday we're no longer dependent on Middle Eastern oil. That people say, well, why can't, if you, once you get the fuel, why can't you just convert your fleet instantly? We've got 200 million cars out there. It takes a while for new automobiles to become the main, the dominant part of the automobile fleet. But what I'm telling you is that we're close to some breakthroughs. These are exciting times. Technology is going to help keep this country competitive. But the thing that's going to keep the country most competitive is making sure our workforce has got the skills to compete. This is a dynamic world. Whether people want to recognize it or not, we're a competitive world. Some will say it's so competitive, let's withdraw and protect ourselves. That's not my attitude. My attitude is it's competitive. Let's get in a position where we can outcompete the rest of the world. And the most important place is going to be to make sure our kids have got the skills to fill the jobs of the 21st century. If our kids don't have those skills, those jobs will go somewhere else. And so this is the initiative that I praise Lamar about. It's called the American Competitiveness Initiative. It basically says that we're going to focus on research, both in public and private sector, to make sure that the technologies and skill base of our science and engineering community leads the world. It also recognizes that we've got to make sure our children have got math and science skills. By the way, that starts with making sure children can read. One of Laura's most important initiatives, inherited in No Child Left Behind Act, is the absolute demand by our government that schools teach every single child how to read by fourth grade or third grade and remain at grade level throughout their entire public school career. One of the ways to make sure that our children have got math and science skills that will give them the basis in which to compete. And by the way, when you test our scores relative to other children, we're doing just fine. Elementary school, and we start slipping off in middle school, and not over to darn high school. And so one way to reverse that trend is to make sure our high school teachers have got the necessary skills to teach kids the skill sets to be able to compete. And so we believe that we can help train 70,000 high school teachers to lead advanced placement courses in math and science. Advanced placement works. AP is a vital program. If you study your AP results here in Tennessee schools, you'll see it makes a lot of sense. We want AP programs to be available to children from all walks of life so that they have the skills necessary to compete. We've got a plan to get 30,000 math and science professionals to teach in our classrooms. And we want to make sure that, just like we do on No Child Left Behind, that we focus on math as well, and we find math deficiencies early, we provide money to correct them. See, if you diagnose and don't correct, you're doing a child a disservice. If you don't diagnose, you're doing a child a disservice. The best thing to do is what we're doing is diagnose and solve problems early before they're too late. And that's what we're going to do in this very exciting initiative. Other things I want to talk about. What I just told you is how to stay competitive. We have a choice. We withdraw and say, okay, y'all go do your thing, we'll just protect ourselves and save America, or we can compete. And I just laid out an agenda for America to lead. I believe that the way you enhance prosperity for the American people is you shape your own destiny. And America has been a leader and will continue to be a leader in the world economy. What really matters in the long term is the character of the American people. You know, the great strength of this country is the compassion of our citizens. It really is. I like to remind people that Tocqueville got it right when he came and looked at America in the 1830s and recognized the voluntary associations, the ability for people to serve something greater than themselves. It was the strength of America then, and it's the strength of America now. One of the reasons why I mentioned Laura's program, Laura was at the program, because I don't really want to give her time. But she's had a very important effort to encourage mentors to help say to a child, what can I do to help you? How can I help you realize you need to make the right choices in life in order to succeed? I see a scout there. I met with the scouting program is a great mentoring program. The program that but there are all kinds of ways you can help. All kinds of ways you can help. Get involved with people's lives. Last night, we honored some folks by putting them in a box there during the city. I guess it's an honor to sit there and listen to one guy for an hour. one of the young guys that's volunteering down there for those affected by the hurricanes. You know, one of the things about the hurricane, we're going to make sure that we analyze the response. And as I said, we just didn't do as good a job as we should have, and all of us in government, as the head of the federal government, I take responsibility for that. But, you know, having said that, the response of the American people to these hurricanes was unbelievable. People were uprooted out of their homes. They were wandering out there, wondering whether or not anybody here, and thousands of our fellow citizens had up their arms and said, I care about you. How can I help you? It was a remarkable thing to watch. Just reaffirm my great faith in the American people. The government's got a role. As I mentioned last night, we've committed $85 million to help the people get on their feet down there. We will stay with them. We'll help them. And the American people are helping them as well. Another thing I talked about last night to make sure that our country is hopeful and spirits are up is that when you look at Washington, you've got to be assured that people are upholding the integrity that you expect them to. I look forward to working with Congress on ethics reform. When we have a solemn duty and an obligation to say to the American people that we will uphold the honor of the offices to which we have been elected. I do want to say something about judges. I want to thank both senators here for voting to confirm a good man, Laura and I. If I can ever stop speaking here, we're going to go back and have a swearing-in ceremony for Judge Sam Alito. I'm going to keep. The reason I bring this up is that part of making sure America knows there's a hopeful tomorrow is that that a lot of Americans don't like it when judges kind of write the law. We got plenty of legislators in Washington. Believe me, we got plenty of legislators in Washington. And so I'm going to put judges on the bench and know the difference between, you know, interpreting the Constitution and trying to write the law. I'll continue to do that. And so that's what's on my mind. And it took me an hour to tell you. I hope you get the sense of my optimism about the country. You know, I told you mine is a decision-making job. I first learned that when a guy called me, I was getting ready to be give my inaugural address right before the swearing in the first president, the first term. A guy called me and said, "What color rug do you want?" I said, "Man, the Oval Office." I said, "This is a decision-making job." Oh, right. Second thing about decision-making is you've got to know when it's time to delegate. So, not knowing much about road design, I said, "Laura, give me a hand." And the third thing about my job is you got to set a strategic vision. Set the strategic vision last night for our country, active in the pursuit of our own security and the spread of freedom, confident in our ability to compete in the world, understanding we need to continually recommit ourselves to serving others. And so I said, Laura, the only thing I want in that letter to say, you figure out how to say it, is optimistic person comes here to work every day. She captured my spirit because I'm optimistic about our future. Thanks for giving me a chance to share that optimism. God bless you.